Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. Al Murray's passion for military history and the Second World War in particular has always run parallel with his comedy, brought to the fore with several acclaimed and award-winning television shows and recent huge success of his podcast, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, with James Holland, who you know I've interviewed a couple of times on this show. Delighted to be joining me live on the line with his first historical book, Al Murray and Command. Al, good morning to you.
Morning.
Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Bit of a departure. I mean, you said in the notes that it's a bit disturbing when people come around to your house because they look at the bookshelves and there are the good, the bad, and the downright ugly staring down at pictures, particularly Adolf. It's a thing. It's the bane of a historian, isn't it? You have certain books that make people go, okay, we might just be getting our coats and going home now.
Well, yeah, books you can't read on the beach, basically. Hitler glaring at everybody. I grew up in the 1970s and I had an action man and I made AFX models and I watched The Great Escape on bank holiday weekends. There's a certain generation, I think, of British people for whom the Second World War is this unavoidable elephant in the room. But I have always been really, really fascinated. I did a history degree, and when I did my history degree, the frustration was you didn't talk about that. It wasn't regarded as particularly a serious topic for discussion when you could talk about the Renaissance or the Enlightenment or something like interesting like that. And so, anyway, I've since then, you know, and in later life, sort of really embraced my interest in the subject.
Yeah, but
it's an amazing subject.
But crop rotation is a thing that has to be done, you know, leaving the fields fallow, Al.
Well, yes, and of course leads to campaigning season that you do around your harvest. I know. But the thing for me about the Second World War is it also has a big footprint on my family. My mother never knew her father because he was killed outside Dunkirk in 1940, the fighting in a town called Harzbrook in northern France. And then my father's father did strange stuff, probably with SOE, Special Operations Executive, with the Foreign Office, and maybe, and was certainly adjacent to Bletchley Park and stuff like that. Although we don't really know because he was very secretive about it. It's quite hard to find him. So there's that sort of mystery as well. There's the very clear thing that happened to one grandfather and the mystery around the other.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because all of us who were children of the 70s and grew up with, you know, Commando and Battle comics, which would now be banned completely. For you, Fritz, the war is over, etc.
All that.
But, you know, it was our grandfathers, wasn't it? I mean, and they didn't, mainly they didn't talk about it. I mean, a lot of them, they either talked too much about it or not at all. So it is an interesting footprint.
Absolutely.
When it comes to then writing a book, you know, and just a small book, not much there, you know, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. I mean, did you just think, you know, blimey, O'Reilly, I've done it now?
Well, I mean, I came at this. This book is the fruits of that pandemic that we had that everyone wants to forget about. And because I was suddenly sat on my behind not touring, because I'm a touring comic. I'm normally on the road. I'm touring right now. We're squeezing this in before I have to get in a car and go somewhere. And so I suddenly had this void of time appear. So James Holland and I decided to really go for it with our podcast, with We Have Ways of Making You Talk, which has turned into a fascinating thing with this sort of lovely little community around it, people all helping each other out online, which is really rather lovely, as well as being interested in sort of anti-tank guns. Anyway, the point is that then attracted the attention of some of my editors, this lovely guy called Ian McGregor, who is himself a Second World War historian. And he said, why don't you write this book and why don't you write about people you're interested in and see what narrative narrative emerges? And that's what the book does. I've got these 10 characters at 10 stages of the Second World War and what the Allies are doing wrong, because they start by losing, as everyone knows, and then they turn it round. How they start off, what they're getting wrong to start with, and how the penny eventually drops.
But how do you put this all into a continuous narrative? Because it's the Second World War, and we're not just talking the Western campaign. You know, we're talking El Alamein, we're talking Monty. Yeah. Are we looking at the Pacific as well? Are we looking at those campaigns too?
Well, no. I mean, in the introduction, I lay my cards on the table and say this is too big a subject for anyone to write about meaningfully. So you're going to get what you're given, right? And so it's eight British officers, British or British and Dominion's officers, because after all, the British effort is imperial in the sense that London is the centre of the imperial world. So you've got people coming and going through London from South Africa, from New Zealand, from Canada, and then they're sort of half British, half Canadian, New Kiwi, whatever. But that's the way the empire worked. You know, if you were a decent chap in Wellington, you could walk into a job in London in the army. It's a really interesting thing. Anyway, so I've got eight. Dominions, UK and Empire people, and then two Americans, because I had to include that, but the American side of it is really, really interesting, because the Americans didn't really, I mean, it's hard to imagine this, but before 1939, the Americans didn't really have an army. They had this little tiny army. It was their military was like, sort of like a think tank, with all these blokes arguing with each other in a sort of collegiate style, but not actually having any stuff. I think they built 18 tanks in 1939, and by 1945, they'd built 50,000 Sherman tanks just out of thin air. So there's this element that America jumpstarts everything. So I've got Bradley and Patton, who are two headline generals, to talk about that, about how they basically create an army out of thin air, and then what leadership means to in different styles. So you've got like Bradley's like an ordinary guy general, and then you've got Patton, who's this sort of crazy out there, I'm your fighting son of a bitch general guy. And so it's the contrast of those two styles. And lots of American generals kind of fall between the pair.
It's an interesting though, isn't it? Because it's how the Allies learnt to win the Second World War. And if you look at the way that, you know, the Wehrmacht was set up, I mean, that was a professional army that had been in training, you know, planning up for this for a long time, that nobody was ready for Blitzkrieg. It left the, you know, the British Expeditionary Force completely bamboozled, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
But however, they weren't able to, if you like, to learn from their mistakes, and they became paranoid. And obviously, once orders were coming out of Berlin from the Nazis rather than the generals themselves, they couldn't change, and yet the Imperial Army, if you like, which you thought would have been hidebound by tradition and structure, was able to think on its feet.
Well, the really interesting thing about the way the British, because the British Empire has two armies. It's got the British Army and the Indian Army, and the Indian government is compelled to spend the same amount of money on its army as the Indian Imperial government as the British Army does. So there's this weird sort of twins relationship. And people come and go between the two. Some people's officers settle in India and become Indian Army officers. Anyway, but the idea is, in the British Army, there's no point figuring out a centralized way of doing things, because who knows where you'll end up. You might end up in Malta on garrison duty. You might end up in the Hindu Kush. You might like fighting in the border, like doing great game stuff for the Russians. You might be putting down an uprising in the Assam Hills. You might be in Sudan doing imperial policing, right? So there's no point having a centralized way of doing things. It's the British attitude. So what that means is, when a war starts, no one knows what to do. They're completely caught with their trousers down. And then if you stay in it long enough, you figure out what to do. You've got a flexible enough system to then figure out what to do and perfect what to do. And by the end of the war, you know, the British Army is this incredibly ruthless, basically war machine. It's the most extraordinary. By 1944, for the start of the invasion of Normandy, and you know, it's happening in Italy and in Burma, all this, it's turned into this incredibly efficient, ruthless machine that is also taking care of the men and making sure the men are okay and willing to fight and happy enough within their situation. And that's amazing, because the disaster in 1940 is all to do with people looking in the wrong direction and worrying about the wrong things and being concerned about, you know, the wrong stuff, and not having any idea what the Germans might throw at them as well.
I've always been taught that 1942 El Alamein, that's the turning point. That's the one that, you know, kickstarts the whole British, if you like, you know, Britain comes back at that point.
Yeah.
Did your research show any new light on that, or am I off the mark on that, or were there smattering signs that happened already?
Well, certainly in the West, that is the case. I mean, the thing is, the list of defeats is. You know, Norway, April 1940, France, May, June 1940, Greece in the spring of 41, Crete, May 41, stalemate at the end of the crusade at the end of the year, which is the British count as a victory, but they don't actually, it's not decisive. Burma in December 41, Singapore, February 42, the Western Desert battles in May, June 1942, which are a disaster, and then El Alamein. But what happens then is it carries on going wrong in Burma well into 1943, and there's this terrible second Arakan offensive, a first Arakan offensive, which is an absolute disaster. And and then the first Chindit expedition as well, which is also a complete disaster. But somehow the British spin it into a victory. And it's only really 1944 where suddenly everything... And you know, things are going well in North Africa after Alamein, because you've done this massive victory in Tunisia. 250,000 German soldiers captured, all their kit gone. You know, so there are big victories, but still aren't getting it right until, you know, not everything's going well until 1944. You know, basically, it takes the British 2.5 years to scratch their heads, figure out, build the right equipment, order the right equipment, you know, blah, 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 and figure out how to use it. And that's the sort of, that's the story of the war, really.
I like that you mentioned the Chindits, because that's one of my favourite little bits, you know, Wingate's Chindits. And also it marks out the fact that the British weren't fighting, they got away from that sort of form square and let Wellington do it. It was like, okay, yeah, let's do guerrilla warfare, let's try this. And also, you know, you mentioned Bletchley Park, but, you know, for the hidebound British intelligence services and SOE and all that, they were fighting a war that was probably seen as non-British when we just wanted to go over there and have a good slog at each other.
Well, I think that's a really, really interesting point, because when you start to push into actually what the British attitude to the Second World War is within government, is it really is, let's slit as many throats as we possibly can. and this goes into the strategic bombing campaign. You know, there's nothing gentlemanly about that, firebombing cities. And you know, the intention is to, well, maybe if we don't hit the factory, at least kill the worker. You know, like, all right, okay, that's how you see it. And so that there is actually, at the heart of the British establishment, there is this completely ruthless way of doing things. And the guerrilla warfare thing is always basically seen as a way of doing it on the cheap, if you possibly can, rather than, you know, dashing skullduggery or adventure. It's like, right, okay, that sounds cheaper than deploying a conventional division. Let's see if that works. And there's always this thing in the British war effort, certainly, where they're always trying to save money, because the lesson of the First World War is it was far too expensive in terms of men and machinery. And you had no one to work at, you know, the factory workforce was depleted after the First World War. You'd spend all this money. So the idea is to try and not spend any money, which is why British uniforms don't look cool, like, or don't have that sort of chic element that the German uniforms have, which is sort of the product of a militaristic society where you've got to have snazzy uniforms. British battle dress is basically a boiler, you know, it's a boiler suit in two halves. It's not meant to look natty.
Nobody's wearing sort of, you know, flying jackets. I mean, they'll wear US flying jackets with a Enola Gay on the side or whatever, because it's cool. But something from the, you know, from the, I don't know, the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, it doesn't have the same effect.
No, exactly. And also, you know, if you're a German Lancer in a knee-high leather boot, the leather that requires costs twice as much as an ankle boot. You know, and the British are thinking, no, we're not going to do knee-high boots. That's ridiculous. That'll cost us too much money. So the British soldiers are walking around. You know, it's the John Glenn when he was strapped into the rocket. You know, the first American in space. He famously said, you know, I'm going. This was built by the lowest bidder. Basically, the British Army is equipped with lowest bidder equipment. In essence, you know, the Sten gun is famously shonkily made. I mean, they get it right in the end, but like the whole point is to make things as cheaply as possible, as quickly as possible. So that's the other thing that runs through the British war effort like a stick of rock. Is how can we do this? How can we do this cheaper?
Yeah. But-
and then you've got that problem. The soldiers all know the stuff's cheap and they lose faith in it, and then they won't fight. So there's this very fine line that the British have to walk with their equipment.
But if you drop a bunch of public schoolboys over some foreign corner of a foreign field, you know, and a couple of Celts for backbone, and if you do lose them, there are a couple of thousand coming out of the minor public schools in the UK, so you'll be okay.
Well, yeah, that's certainly what they were relying on to start with. And then they ran out of minor public schoolboys. And then, you know, they expand the officer selection. This officer selection board gets expanded. You know, people of all classes have the opportunity to be killed at the rate that officers are killed at, you know, like, hooray!
Hooray!
Hooray for democracy.
Exactly, and equal opportunities for killing machine. Just quickly, exactly. I mean, can we just quickly mention Churchill and morale? I mean, morale obviously built, because you've got the morale of the Blitzkrieg, and the the Wehrmacht think they're invincible, and all they're seeing him peeled off their little nuts as they steamroll through the Low Countries, and then they lose morale. And the way, and one of my things is the Third Reich, which gets me very interesting looks in my bookshelf. I can tell you, Unity Mitford, etc. It's the way that the morale crumbles in Germany, and those last days in Berlin are just a movie dying to be made, a proper one. Churchill, morale, and the way, and to a certain extent Eisenhower as well, the way that their figures inspire, has that been over egged, do you think?
No, I think there is this very strange thing that happens, and the British establishment basically ends up in the Second World War. Kind of, Chamberlain is basically goes to war in 1939 because he's been essentially, British foreign policy has been made a fool of. This is my opinion. I mean, this is massive contentious issue, but basically, we don't go to war to defeat the Nazis. We go to war because Hitler sort of like fooled us one, won't get fooled again. It's got that thing. And the English, the British, and the French governments both look each other in the eye in September 1939. And go, well, you're gonna declare war? We made a guarantee. You're gonna. And there's a sort of couple of days of that, which is why Germans invade on the 1st and war's declared on the 3rd. You know, there's this, but then you get through the phony war, you get this essential idea in the British establishment that maybe something will turn up. We won't have to fight this war. And what's different is when Churchill comes in, and it's interesting, it's pure coincidence that he comes in the day, you know, the Chamberlain's government falls the day that the day that the invasion of France and the Low Countries begins. It's a sheer coincidence that May the 10th is the day those two things happen. And then the calamity that unfolds in France, the Blitzkrieg and everything, is nothing to do with Churchill. So he's able to inherit a situation that's a disaster that he can't be blamed for. So he's in this very peculiar political situation where he can go, right, this is what we need to do. And no one can say, yeah, but you got us in this mess. So he's in a very, very weirdly fortunate position. And he is absolutely the right person to be banging on desks and saying, we can't compromise with these people. Because there are a lot of attempts to put out feelers via the Italians. You know, Lord Halifax, the foreign secretary, is trying to do that. And there's resistance, you know, in this debate in cabinet as to whether actually we need to cut a deal with the Germans. And Churchill is absolutely key to making that not happen. And basically, there's a sort of fortnight of panic. And then it kind of passes, and the army gets out of Dunkirk, and it kind of passes. And the truth is, I think, and you know, whenever this may never be truly revealed, is that the British government, the chiefs of Imperial General Staff, apart from maybe on one afternoon when they have this weird wobble, are absolutely convinced there won't be an invasion. But what they need is the fear of one to galvanize the population and get the British people on side, rather than have them go, you know what, maybe this isn't worth it. And Churchill's central to that.
When you started to sit down and write this book during the lockdown, you know a lot about it, obviously, but the things are revealed. And did your thoughts change? Was there a moment where you went, either I didn't realise that, or did you have what I call a eureka moment? I've got this. This is going to be good.
Yeah, particularly with one of the chapters, a chapter about a guy called Percy Hobart, about tank warfare. I was really interested. I've always been interested in him. He's a fascinating character, and he has this peculiar story in that he's a real innovator and he's a proper thinker and all that. And he's also like one of those my way or the highway guys. He doesn't get on with anyone and all that. And that's how he's always been portrayed. But the reason he didn't get on with anyone wasn't just because he was like one of the clearer thinkers around. It's that basically when he was teaching at the staff college in the Indian Army Staff College in Quetta, he had an affair with one of his pupils' wives, who he then married, and he was named as the correspondent in their divorce. And this is the time of the abdication crisis, right? So divorce isn't just like, you know, tragically normal like it is now. It was like a really, really, really big deal. And it cost him, well, he was at the War Office at the time, issued a memo, said, if you do this, you've got to resign your commission. You've got to leave the army. And he refused. So he'd upset the War Office, so the entire military establishment. He upset, when he was posted to the Middle East, he upset his commanding officer's wife, didn't like the fact that he'd married a divorcee. And so basically poisoned, you know, whispered in his boss's ear about how he was a rotter and a cad. And that basically brought his army career, and he was one of the clear thinking people about what to do with tanks, brought his army career completely to a grinding halt. And by 1940, he was in the Home Guard. He was a corporal in the Home Guard. He went from being a general, major general, to being a corporal in the Home Guard, and then started bossing people around and organizing. But basically, his career was over. And then you have this, the Blitzkrieg thing, where the Germans use tanks in a way that surprises everybody. Churchill's going, who knows about this? Who have we got that knows about this? And the army go, well, there's Hobart, but you can't really have him because he's a rotter, you know, he's a cad and all that. And basically Churchill's like, I don't care. Like, let me speak to him. And that's the sort of how he then comes back into the fold. But what's really interesting about him is when it comes to tank warfare, you have a load of people who never change their mind about what they're going to do, and have made their minds up in the 30s about what they're going to do, and then they never change their minds. And that happens in the German military establishment. So people like Guderian, Rommel, they figure out what they're going to do with tanks in the very late 30s and in 1940, and then they never change their minds. Hobart comes in, and he completely, when he's given the job, he raises two armored divisions, the 7th and the 11th, and then he raises 79th Armored Division, which is like this specialist thing that has floating tanks and funny tanks and flamethrowers and all this kit, all this gear. And mate, and flail tanks. It's amazing.
Yeah, flail
tanks.
Love those.
Yeah, exactly. And he's asked to organize that division and purpose it for the D-Day landings. And basically completely changes his thinking. He completely changes. So he shows this man's got and that was a eureka moment, realizing that, and also it's kind of writing that in light of what was happening in Ukraine, where you saw these great long columns of tanks the Russians had, all, and it all going wrong for them. He had decided that wasn't the way to do things. He moved away from it, even though that was the thing he wanted to do, in 1940. And that's really interesting, that the Allies had people at their disposal who were clever enough to have brilliant ideas, but then also clever enough to move on to new ideas. And that's essentially how the Allies learned to win the Second World War, to change their thinking, to adjust their thinking, and to adapt to the circumstances they found themselves in.
So now that you're a published historical author, Al, how do you... And I'll just leave that there. You can use that as a ringtone.
But
how do you think it's going to be when you sit back down to do the podcast with James Holland? Because obviously, I mean, I've got a couple of his things on my bookshelf next to the Unity Mitford biography.
Well, he's very... I mean, he's been incredibly... supportive in this. He's been, I mean, he read an early draft. He's been absolutely fantastic helping with it. He's encouraged me to stick to my guns with some of the arguments I've got in the book. He's a very, very, very good friend of mine and an absolutely brilliant person to work with. So to write a book that kind of in his lee has been a really, really brilliant thing to have done.
So what's up next, Al? I mean, thanks for spending some time with me this morning, but because I know Sorry. You're off on tour. Has this planted the seed then? It's going to be the first of many historical books, do you think?
Well, I'm thinking about what I might write for a next one. And I've got an idea, but I don't want to talk about it until A, I know I can make it fly, and B, my publisher says, I like the sound of that.
Will it have flail tanks in it?
It probably won't.
Oh.
It probably won't.
Oh.
It probably not this one. Not this one. But I mean, but I might. One of the things is I do tend to digress when I'm writing. My writing style is like our podcast, where we digress a lot. So there may well be. I may end up digressing about flail tanks. Maybe just for you.
Thanks. Well, I'll look forward to that. And for you, Fritz, the war is over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The book is called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. It's by Al Murray, who we've been speaking to this morning. Al, I was going to say, if people find you online, where can they find you? But I think you're quite easy to track down. when's the next podcast out then, just so we know?
Oh, well, we do. Well, there's one out Thursday, Tuesdays and Thursdays that go out. And then there's a Patreon that we've got for really diehard listeners, where there's extra content. So what I've been doing is reading out of print memoirs and stuff and putting them up as audiobooks, and they're rather good fun.
Brilliant. This book is called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. It's by Al Murray. Al, thank you so much for your time today.
A total pleasure. Thanks, Charles.